Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Let's get into it. Hello my beautiful people. So we're coming to the end of book one of Ben Okri's Famished Road. I'm going to be reading 13 and 14 for you today. Can I just say I'm so happy and I'm so grateful for Farida and Mariam who joined me to read to you guys the first book in the Famished Road. It has been a roller coaster ride. This boy don't hear what Azaro does not hear what, but yeah, it has been incredible. We are finally entering the place where I actually myself stopped reading, which is Madame Couture's side and everything. And I'm not going to go into how I feel about it because we're going to do an episode with Farida. I'm going to do an episode with Farida where I talk to you guys about it. We talk to you guys about like the journey so far and whatnot. But yeah, this has been nice. Oh my God. Oh, it took us like a month, can you believe, to finish book one. So here it goes. Book one, 13. I learned that Dad had gone out early to look for a job. Mom was exhausted from the search, the feast, all the walking and worrying and the cooking. That morning, she brought out her little table of provisions to the house front. She sat on a stool with me beside her and dispiritedly crowned out her wares. The dust blew into our eyes. The sun was merciless on our flesh. We didn't sell a single item. In the afternoon, the people that Dad had borrowed money from came to collect their money. Okay, anyways, let's go. So, book one, 13. I learned that Dad had gone out early to look for a job. Mom was exhausted from the search and the feast and the walking, the worrying and the cooking. That morning, she brought out her little table of provisions to the house front. She sat on a stool with me beside her and dispiritedly crowned out her wares. The dust blew into our eyes. The sun was merciless on our flesh. We didn't sell a single item. In the afternoon, the people that Dad had borrowed from to buy drinks came to collect their money. They threatened to seize Mom's goods. They hung around till evening. Mom begged them to wait for Dad to get back, but they wouldn't listen. What annoyed Mom the most was the fact that the creditors were people from our compound, who were at the feast, who had gotten drunk on our wine and had thrown up on our windowsill. The loudest among them was actually responsible for breaking the back of the chair and destroying two glasses. Another one of our creditors, as we learned later, was Madame Couture. She was the only one who did not come to drag for her money. But the others hung around Mom's store and spoiled her prospects of business. By the evening, Mom had begun to cough. Her eyes were inflamed from all the dust, and whenever she stood up, she staggered. When she went to the backyard, she weaved about a little, as if her failure to attract customers and shake off the creditors had made her drunk. Then I noticed, when she returned, that her eyes had gone strange. Every once in a while, after crooning desperately to the indifferent potential customers of the world, her eyes would roll around in their sockets. As the evening wore on, when the winds changed and a chill insinuated itself into the passing of the sun, Mom began to quiver on her stool. Her teeth shattering, she went on stubbornly trying to sell her provisions, quivering under the bad wind, her face taut, her nose sweating, her eyes a little distracted. The other compound woman, who noticed the change, told her to rest, but she didn't move. We sat there with our wares on the table in the dark, covered in dust. When Mom finally packed up her table, the evening had deepened, and the wind had begun to whistle in the tall trees. Trembling, determined, and silent, she washed all our clothes in the backyard. She cleaned the room, made a fresh pot of stew and pounded yam for Dad's dinner, and then, battered by exhaustion, she went to sleep. But the creditors allowed her no rest. In a renewed effort, they came turning up outside our room, whispering about the money we owed them, exaggerating the amounts to each new gossip monger, and knocking on our door. When Mom reached the limit of her tolerance, she shouted at them. They vowed loudly never to sell anything on credit again. They went on demanding their money till night fell. We began to worry about Dad. It got darker and darker. The night birds began their songs, and still he hadn't returned. When we had exhausted ourselves with worry, when Mom was asleep on the bed and I was dozing on the floor, Dad stomped outside and came into the room, bringing angry shadows with him. His bad temper stank from his alcoholic breath. He lit a candle, saw Mom asleep on the bed, and burst into rage. "I have been everywhere in the world looking for a job to feed us, and you are asleep? Wicked woman that you are." Dad fumed and shouted for 30 minutes without listening, without using his eyes. Mom got out of bed, trembling violently, and went to the kitchen. "Mom is not well," I said. "There is nothing wrong with her. She's just wicked, that's all." "She's not well," I said again. He didn't hear me. Mom came in with his tray of food. The plates clattered because of her trembling, which she tried to control. Dad, in his fury, didn't look up at her. He ate noisily with all his might and mighty appetite. He didn't even give me pieces of fish or invite me to join him, as he often did. After he had finished eating every single morsel on the plate, his mood calmed and he told us about how he had walked the entire city under the blistering heat waves looking for a job and had found none. During the silence which followed, Mom told him about the creditors, and Dad found fresh reason to be angry. He threatened that he was going to beat them up for harassing Mom. He said he would scatter their teeth all over the forest. He said he would beat them so thoroughly that they would become old men overnight. "I will feed their brains to the wind," he shouted. Mom expended a great deal of energy trying to dissuade him from such violent measures. But a demon of anger had gone into Dad, and he fumed and cursed all through the night. He smoked cigarettes after cigarettes, cleaning his joints, striding them up and down, filling the room with his relentless temper. He grumbled about how much he had helped people and how they had always let him down, about all the creditors who came to our feast, polished off our boar's meat and beer, and turned around to harass Mom at the first opportunity. He complained bitterly about how people ate off him and then stabbed him in the back. I had heard these complaints all my life. His cigarettes burned angrily as he dredged up a fresh variation. Mom would wake up suddenly. His blistering tirade was aimed at everything. I fell asleep with Dad cursing the treachery of the world way into my dreams. When I woke up, Mom was sweating and quivering on the bed. Dad had bought malaria medicines and bitter roots, which were marinated in yellow alcohol. Mom's teeth clattered, her eyes were at odd angles, and Dad sat beside her, his bad arm folded, the blood dried on his bandaged head. He applied warm compress to her face and forehead. I got up and greeted Mom, but she could barely speak. She held me tightly to her hot body, and I began to tremble myself. She held me so tightly that my teeth shattered as well, and soon I felt myself being invaded by her fever. My eyeballs became hot. Dad, noticing what was happening to me, snatched me from Mom's frightening embrace and made me drink of the bitter dogonyaro as a precaution. Then he ordered me to go and bathe. I cleaned my teeth and bathed, and when I got back, Dad had prepared some food. We sat and ate together from the same bowl while Mom heaved in her illness on our bed. We had finished eating and Dad was preparing to go out when the creditors came one after the other, as if they had planned it. They knocked on the door, came in, said something vaguely nice about me, expressed their profuse sympathies for Mom, praying that she should recover soon. They asked if Dad's wounds had improved, didn't wait for a reply, then they left. Minutes later, with the air of people who had forgotten something of less than vital importance, they came back again, one after the other, and reminded Dad of how much he owed them, how they didn't usually lend money or give credits, and how this was a special case, and how hard things were at the shop, and so on. They ended by expressing their sympathies again to Mom and left. Their sly and hypocritical manner got Dad very enraged. He paced the room, boiling in fury. Then suddenly, unable to contain himself any longer, he stormed out of the room. I followed him. He went to the backyard and we saw all the creditors huddled together, talking in low business tones, as though they were about to form a limited liability company. Dad went amongst them, scattering the meeting. They tried to run to their different rooms, but Dad called them back, each by his particular name, and he insulted them for 15 incandescent minutes. They bore his insults in silence. When he had finished with them, turning with his unique dismissive flourish and storming back to our room, everyone was aware that we had just made ourselves three new enemies in the compound. As Dad left, the creditors regrouped and talked more intensely than before. They were like demented conspirators. When I got back to the room, Dad had dressed up in his black French suit. He offered libations to his ancestors and prayed for Mom's recovery. Then he wore his only pair of boots, which gave the room a poignant smell of leather, old socks, and foot sweat. As he went out of the door, Mom woke up from her sleep screaming. She wouldn't stop, and Dad held her and gave her more dogonyaro, and she twisted around on the bed, and then just as suddenly she became still, with tears running down her face and collecting in her ears. Dad stayed with her a while and watched her tossing in her sleep. When her sleep had become a little more regular, Dad told me not to leave her side and to take care of her, that he had to go and find some money and would be back soon. He went out with his head hung low, as if for the first time acknowledging the blows from above. I sat on Dad's chair and watched over Mom. I watched her sleeping face till my eyes began to throb. Then suddenly Mom got up, her upper body stiff, her eyes unfocused, and she began to speak in an unfamiliar language. She stood up and went around the room, cleaning things, straightening the table, folding the clothes, brushing Dad's shoes, fidgeting amongst the pots and basins, speaking in this unnatural language all the while. "Mother," I cried. She neither heard nor saw me. She picked up blackened pots and pans with dented bottoms and went out of the room. I followed her, tugging at her till one layer of her wrapper came off in my hands. She went to the kitchen, still muttering in a newfound tongue. Her eyes blank, she started a fire in the grate and began to cook an imaginary pot of stew. She did everything mechanically, her body acting without her mind, as if she were in a dream. When the firewood blazed, she placed an empty pot on the grate and sat on a stool and stared at the pot till it started to give off an arid smell of burning metal. "Mom," I cried again. She turned towards me, looked right through me, got up, went out of the kitchen and collapsed beside the well. I screamed and women rushed to us and carried her to our room. She lay on the bed breathing heavily and the women stood around, casting deep shadows, hands to their breasts, head low, standing in silence as if in the presence of a corpse. I sat on Dad's chair and watched over her. Women left and returned with confusing medications in green jars and dark bottles, and they administered conflicting treatments and made her drink strange potions, drugs, oils, and distillates. Mom slept, breathing hoarsely, and the women left. I watched over her till my stomach ached and my eyelids became heavy. Then I woke up with a start. Mom's breathing had changed. I listened. I watched. Then I noticed that her breathing had become almost inaudible. The room changed. Voices sang in my head. A lizard clambered onto the bed and ran over Mom's arm. And then everything seemed to stop for a moment. It seemed my own breathing had ceased altogether. I drew a breath and a spider fell from the ceiling. I drew another and I fell off the chair. I got up and sat again, and then it became clear that it was Mom who had stopped breathing. Flies played around her mouth. She didn't stir. Then as I watched, as I listened, a sharp pain went through my ears. Colors and masks appeared in my eyes. And then as I held my breath, I saw a blue mist rising from Mom's form. I heard a child crying. The lizard scuttled past my feet. I woke Mom up and still she didn't stir. I called her and she didn't move. The blue mist grew thicker over her like steam from a boiling cauldron of water. And it collected and became more defined. And I grew really scared when the mist changed colors rapidly, becoming green and then yellow, turning red, bursting into a golden glow, and back to blue again. It turned reddish silver, radiant in the darkness of the room. I couldn't bear it any longer. When she didn't move, didn't breathe, I ran all the way to Madame Couture's bar to tell her that my mother was dying. The bar was shut. At the backyard, Madame Couture, wearing blue wrappers and a red blouse and filthy red head tie, struggling with a huge chicken. Madame Couture, I called. She glared at me, striking me dumb. And the chicken flew out of her hands. She pursued it into the bushes, grabbed it firmly, gave me a sour look and said, "Your father owes me money." Then she forgot about my presence altogether. The chicken fought in her hands and she grabbed its thickly feathered neck. Twisting her mouth, she held the chicken's body down with her foot and sliced its throat with jagged motions of her long knife. The chicken's blood burst out from the gash, staining the air, splattering my face, deepening the red of her blouse. The blood poured into a hole she had dug in the earth, and the chicken fought, its comb rising and falling, its mouth opening and shutting in its final spasm. And when it died, its eyes were open. They stared at me. Then Madame Couture washed the knife, sweat dribbling down her face and breast. She regarded me with big eyes, as if she was going to swallow me. I was crying. "Because of a chicken," she said, sucking her teeth. She reached for a kettle of boiling water. I held on to her blouse, pulling her, my mouth wet, unable to speak. She pushed me away and I fell backwards on the ground and I stayed there, kicking the air, and eventually I said, "My mother is dying." "How do you know?" she asked, eyeing me. "Smoke is coming from her." "Smoke?" "Red smoke," I said. She got up immediately, washed her hands, and started to hurry towards our compound. But at the bar front, she stopped and said, "Go and boil some water. I am coming." I was confused. She went to her room and came out with a handful of herbs, stamped around the bushes, tearing off leaves from plants. Then she fetched a coarse sponge, dark green soap, a black metal container, looked around, saw me, and said, "Go, boil water. I am coming." I rushed home, started a fire in the kitchen, and boiled water in the pan that Mom had burnt. Madame Couture arrived soon afterwards. She washed and boiled the leaves. We went to the room. Mom was still on the bed. The mist above her had almost vanished. Madame Couture tried to put leaves in her mouth, but they merely stayed on her lips. Then she poured the distillate in a cup, added black oils and ogogoro, held Mom's head up, and tried to get her to drink. Mom choked and Madame Couture called her name with such violence, it sounded like a whip. She went on calling Mom's name, whipping out her name, calling back her spirit in a very peculiar bird-like voice. After a long time, Mom opened her eyes and stared at Madame Couture, then at me. She stared at us utterly without comprehension. Her eyes stayed open, unmoving, blank. Grief threw me to the floor and I thrashed about and wailed because I thought Mom had died. Then from a great distance, I heard Mom speak and I fell silent. In a very feeble voice, she said, "I saw my son in the land of death." "Azaro." "Yes. What were you doing, dear?" "I'm here, Mom." She stared beyond me. Madame Couture gave her more of the herbal mixture to drink. Then she made her drink some pepper soup and got her to sit up straight. Then she told me to talk to Mom, to keep talking to her. And as I spoke to Mom about whatever came to my mind, the mist above her changed color and slowly disappeared. "The smoke is going," I cried. Madame Couture opened the door and the window. Light and air filled the room and Mom fell asleep in her sitting position. Her head flopped forward. We stretched her out. I listened to her rough breathing. After a while, Madame Couture said we should at least let her rest. She went back to the bar and to the chicken she had been about to cook for food. I stayed outside our room and kept listening.
I watched the children playing as I listened. When Mom called my name 3 times, I hurried in and sat on the bed. Her face was covered in sweat. The room smelled of illness. There was a little foam on her lip and sweat on her forehead. Her lips quivered. She could scarcely speak. "My son," she said, "I saw you walking on your head. You were walking away from me and I pursued you, but you ran very fast and you were laughing at me, my son." "I'm not laughing at you, Mom." "When I caught you," she continued, "I saw you had no eyes and no mouth, and you had little legs on your head. There was a white rope around you and it went up to the sky. I pulled the rope and it pulled me. I couldn't cut it. And then the rope jumped from your feet to my neck. The rope pulled me up to the sky and I passed the moon and a red cloud shut my eyes." "Mom, your eyes are not shut. It was because of you that the white rope jumped to my neck. What were you doing walking upside down?" "I don't know," I replied. "How did you get little legs on your head?" "I don't know, Mom." "Go and fetch me some water, my son. I'm thirsty." I ran out and fetched water in a clean cup, and when I got back, she was fast asleep. Her breathing was much gentler. Early in the evening, the compound woman came to see how Mom was doing. She sat up and received them. They prayed for her recovery. They left, and Madame Koto came with a bowl of food and another of pepper soup. Mom didn't want to eat. She was so weak, but we pressed her. I washed the plates and took them back to Madame Koto's bar. Then afterwards, the creditors came to ask for Dad under the pretext that they had come to wish Mom well. When Mom saw them, she got very upset and shouted at them, accusing them of poisoning her. I came in and saw Mom staggering and throwing things at them. She was very lean and she swayed when she threw shoes at the creditors. I joined in the attack. They retreated. When they were outside, they cursed us and encouraged their children to throw things at us, and one of them threw a stone which hit Mom on the head and she collapsed at my feet, and a tragic wail rose collectively from the women of the compound. The creditors fled. The women carried Mom into the room. She came to as they crossed the threshold. Her eyes were hard, and when she laid on the bed, she had a strange little smile on her mouth, as if she finally understood something that had always eluded her. The smile stayed on her mouth all evening. I listened to the flies. The sound of the unevening intensified. The flies played on Mom's smile, and she made no attempt to wave them away. I waved them off, and Mom looked at me expressionlessly. I sat on the bed and watched the night creep into the room through the open window. It was quite late when the sound at the door woke us up. I was curled up in a corner of the bed, and Mom's eyes were wide open. I looked up at the door and saw Dad standing there like a tall ghost, his eyes bright, his sling gone. He looked like a giant who had lost. He didn't move for a long moment. Then he lit a candle, shut the window and the door. And when he sat down, a thick cloud of white dust billowed out from the seat of his trousers. His hair was white. His eyelashes were white. His hair was disheveled. He had a bewildered expression on his face that frightened me. His tank of cement, dried fish, gary and white dust. He sat silently for a long moment without moving. When he did move, his joints creaked. His bad arm hung loose by his side. His bandage had gone and the wound was covered in white dust. Then suddenly, out of the silence of the slow-burning candle, he said, "How is your mother?" "She nearly died today. Madame Koto helped us." He breathed deeply, shut his eyes. He was silent and still for a while, and I thought he had fallen asleep. Mom's eyes were open and devoid of expression. "Is there any food?" "No." Dad was silent again. Then, wearing his bathroom slippers, taking his towel and soap, he went to bath. He came back clean and handsome and with all the white dust and the cement smells gone, but his eyes were heavy and he still looked bewildered and he still frightened me. He rubbed himself with oil, combed his hair and lit a mosquito coil, removed the center table and spread the mat. The room stank of his boots and his shoes. He sat on the chair and I lay on my mat, a pillow beneath my head. He smoked into the night. "So what happened today?" he asked after a while. I wanted to tell him about the creditors and Mom, but I felt a certain weariness about him which made the night heavy. So I said Mom nearly died. He released a long sigh. Then he got up, looked down at Mom, placed his palm on her forehead and shut her eyes. He went back to the chair and smoked some more, and I could measure the sadness of his thoughts by the way he dragged on the cigarette and the way he sighed when exhaling. I watched the bright points of his cigarettes in the dark, and it eventually lulled me into Madame Koto's bar. Dad was there. The bar had moved deep into the forest, and all her customers were animals and birds. I sat on a bench, which was really the back of a goose, and I drank off the back of a bull. A massive chicken without feathers strode into the bar, sat next to me, and ordered palm wine and pepper soup. Madame Koto didn't want to serve the chicken, but Dad said, "Serve him." Madame Koto went out and fetched a great broom and chased the chicken round the bar, lashing its head. Dad laughed. The chicken laughed. Madame Couture tripped, fell, and got up. She whacked the chicken on the head and missed. The chicken ran out of the bar, destroying the doorframe, and laughed deep into the forest. I looked round and saw Dad asleep on the chair, his head bent forward, snoring. I woke him up, and he leapt with a start and fell from the chair. When he got up, he said the leopard with glass teeth had been pursuing him in his dreams. He lay down beside me on the mat. When he smelled in my nostrils, he made me worried and unhappy. He was restless beside me, and his bones kept creaking. He kept sighing and muttering words to his ancestors, and I found myself again in Madame Couture's bar deep in the forest. That was the day. The customers this time were all invisible, and I saw air drinking palm wine. Madame Couture sat on a chair made of chicken feathers. Dad began to snore. He snored so hard that the long wooden broom in the corner began to sweep the bar, spreading white dust everywhere. Madame Couture commanded the broom to be still, but Dad went on snoring, and the broom took on a will of its own and attacked the cobwebs and swept the tables. And when he attempted to sweep Madame Couture out of her own establishment, she lost her temper. Then I saw her fighting with the long broom. The broom hit her on the head. I laughed. Dad stopped snoring. She grabbed the broom, threw it over her shoulders, and smashed it on the floor, breaking its neck. The handle of the broom began to bleed. With blood on her face, Madame Couture turned to me, who was dreaming her, and said, "You laughed at me? You are next." She started towards me with a demonic expression, and I cried out. Dad put his arm around me and said, "Go to sleep, my son. Nothing will harm you." After a long silence, as if answering an important question which the night and his parents and his hopes had put to him, he said, "I have been carrying the world on my head today." Soon afterwards, he fell asleep. He slept like a giant. Dad was praying over Mom's body. There was a herbalist in the room. He looked very fierce and 14. Dad was praying over Mom's body. There was a herbalist in the room. He looked very fierce and wise and stank of old leaves. He chewed on a root and his teeth were brown. He sprinkled the room with liquid from a half calabash. There were candles on both sides of Mom's body. She lay on the mat, breathing gently. Her eyelids shone with antimony. Antimony. 14. Dad was praying over Mom's body. There was a herbalist in the room. He looked very fierce and wise and stank of old leaves. He chewed on a root and his teeth were brown. He sprinkled the room with liquid from a half calabash. There were candles on both sides of Mom's body. She lay on the mat, breathing gently. Her eyelids shone with antimony. The cups of her past lay by her face. Razor incisions had been made on her shoulders, and I watched the blood turn black as the herbalist smeared the cut with ash. The herbalist made her sit up and drink from a bowl of bitter liquid. Mom contorted her face. The herbalist began whipping the air, driving out unwanted spirits with his charmed fly whisk. The air crackled with their cries. When he had sealed our space with gnomic spells, he made Mom sit up again. Under our intense gaze, he beat Mom's shoulder and pulled out a long needle and 3 caries from her flesh. He went outside and buried them in the earth. When he had finished with his treatment, Mom fell asleep, looking more peaceful than ever. The herbalist and Dad haggled about money. Dad's voice was straining, and he kept pleading for the charges to be a little lower. The herbalist wouldn't budge. Dad said it was all that he had. The herbalist wouldn't relent. Dad sighed, paid, and they sat talking. I hated the herbalist for taking so much money off Dad, and I cursed him. They talked as if they were friends, and I hated him even more for pretending to be our friend. When he got up to leave, he seemed to notice me for the first time. He stared hard at me and gave me a pound, which I gave to Dad. I took back my curse and he left. I sat on Dad's legs and we watched Mom sleep soundly on the bed. Late in the afternoon, Dad said he was thirsty. He went to the bar. Madame Couture's establishment was empty except for the flies. I heard her singing in the backyard. Dad called her, but she didn't hear. We both called her, banging on the table, and still she couldn't hear us. We were banging away at the table, calling her name, when the front door swung open and a black wind came in and circled us, disappearing into an earthenware pot of water. "Did you see that, Dad?" I asked. "What?" "The black wind." "No." Madame Couture came in, her hair a mess, her hands covered in animal gore. So it's you too, I'm coming. She went back out and minutes later was back, her hands clean, her hair in place. What do you want to drink? Dad ordered the usual palm wine and bushmeat pepper soup. When the wine was served, the flies thickened around us. A wall gecko watched us as we drank. Look at that wall gecko, Dad. Don't mind it, he said without looking. He's our friend watching over us. The pepper soup was hotter than usual and I kept blowing it to cool its fire. Drink some water, Madame Coteau said. No, I don't want any water. Why not? The black wind went into it. What wind? Don't mind him, Dad said. She eyed me suspiciously. You have a strange son, she said, and sat across from us at the table. And a good wife, Dad added. I heard what you did. Thank you. She ignored Dad's gratitude with her big eyes fixed on me. She said, about this money you're owing me. Me? I said, not you, your father. Yes, I'm not like the other people. What other people? The people you owe and who... She stopped looking at Dad and then at me. I will forget the money if you let your son come and sit in my bar now and again. Dad looked at me. Why? He asked. Because he has good luck. What good luck? He has given us nothing but trouble. That's because he is your son. I can't agree. He is going to school. I don't want to go to school, I said. Shut up. Madame Coteau stared at Dad, her eyes brighter. I'll pay for him to go to school. I can pay for my own son, Dad replied proudly. All right, I will forget the money. Just let him come and sit here for 10 minutes every 3 days or so, that's all. Do you want to turn him into a drunkard? His father is not a drunkard. Dad looked at me. He looked at me with new eyes. The wall gecko hadn't moved. It watched us the whole time. I will discuss it with his mother. Good. But these people, I owe money. What about them? What about them? You are going to tell me something. Didn't your son tell you? What? That they threw stones at your wife. Who threw stones? Madame Coteau caught up and fetched some more palm wine. I can't tell you. Dad turned to me and looked so fierce that before he asked me anything, I told him who the people were and what had happened. He downed half a glass of palm wine in one gulp, rubbed the spillings all over his sweating face, and stormed out of the bar without paying. By the time we got to our compound, Dad had managed to whip himself up into a fantastic rage. We ran into one of the creditors who was just coming out of the toilet. Dad went straight up to him and without saying a single word, he fended a right jab at the fellow's face and punched him in the stomach. The creditor bent over grunting and Dad grabbed him around the waist and threw him back first on the floor. When Dad straightened, dusting his hands, he saw another creditor whose son had stoned Mom on the head. The second creditor had witnessed the efficiency of Dad's fury and started to run. Dad chased after him, caught him, tripped him, helped him up, lifted the poor fellow on his shoulders, showed him to the sky and tossed him on the patch of mud. The first creditor, who had quickly recovered from his fall, came running towards us, swinging high a burning firewood. Dad was delighted. He ducked the arc of the firewood and smashed the fellow into the stomach again, and confused him with a repeated left jab to his face. Then, with a cry that amazed everyone, he floored the creditor with a right cross. The second creditor, covered in mud, came at Dad, swearing in three languages. Dad practiced his right jabs on his nose until he began to bleed and then polished him off with a left hook. People had gathered. The second creditor was a motionless heap on the floor, and the wives and relations of the fallen man crowded Dad. He kept hitting at the men, lashing out with both hands in wild swings, intent on entirely separating their heads from their bodies. The men were scared, and in their fear, they walked into Dad swinging punches. He knocked out three of them, and with his bad arm alone, the crowd was mesmerized by his prowess. Boxer, boxer, they chanted. The wives of the creditors pounced on Dad and scratched his face and went for his crotch when I heard him cry out. He managed to put them away. Then he ran. The women and children pursued Dad, who fled from both their rage and from his own fear of hurting them. When they couldn't catch Dad, they turned their anger on me and I fled screaming to Madame Coteau's place and hid behind the earthenware pot. The women and relatives shouted outside. They were too afraid of Madame Coteau's reputation to come in and disrupt her establishment. She heard their noises from the backyard and I saw her securing her wrapper tightly around her waist, in complete readiness for battle as she strutted towards them shouting, "Yes, what do you people want? Wine or war?" The pack of them scattered at Madame Coteau's terrifying advance. When they retreated completely, I came out from behind the earthenware pot. Madame Coteau smiled at me, then she poured me a tumbler of palm wine. I drank with the flies, and later Dad, dodging among the shadows of the bushes, came and joined me on the bench. We drank till it was evening. When I got to my third tumbler, of wine, I noticed that the wall gecko was still staring at us. It had a red stripe on its head. It never nodded, and its eyes were like tiny beads of sapphire. When anyone else looked at the wall gecko, it ran on. "What are you doing? What are you looking at?" Dad asked. "Nothing," I said. When it got dark, Dad sent me to the compound to see if Mom was still asleep. I was reluctant to go. He gave me a good piece of bushmeat and filled my little tumbler with wine, and I drank it all down, and he said, "Be the true son of your father." I smiled jokingly and went out of the bar. The bush paths were quiet. Then I heard a cock crowing and the lively insects and the night birds clearing their voice for their chorus of night songs. I swayed and the world turned and everything became silent again. I passed the tree with blue cloth dangling from a branch and I was about to take the cloth when a dog barked at me. I wasn't scared. I felt for some reason that I knew the dog from somewhere. And when the dog saw that I wasn't afraid, it backed away and trotted off into the forest and I followed its stiffened tail. Then I remembered Mom and continued with my journey to the compound. It was a perfectly straightforward path from Madame Coteau's bar to our house, but the dog had confused me and all the paths had fractured. I followed one path and it led me into the forest. I followed it back and I arrived at a place I had never seen in my life before. All the houses were gigantic, the trees were small, the sky low, the air golden. I tried to get out of this place, but I didn't know how. I took the path back to the forest, but it led me deeper into the land. I stopped and it was quiet and I didn't even hear the flies buzzing or the insect trilling or birds twittering. The heat was different. Then I noticed that nothing in that strange place cast a shadow. The light of the red sun went right through everything. There was no wind. The air was still and cool. When I began walking again, I didn't hear my own footsteps. After a while, I wasn't afraid. In a way, everything became familiar to me and I went on a long fractured path. I walked for a long time. Then I saw a small man coming towards me. He had white stripes on his face. His eyes were green. But when I looked at him properly, something about him changed and I saw that his legs were unnaturally hairy and that his face was upside down on his neck. The features of his face were all scrambled up. His eyes were on his cheeks. His mouth was on his forehead. His chin was full of hair and his head was bald except for his beard. And I couldn't make out his ears. I had to bend my head and twist my thinking to make sense of his features. I couldn't understand how I perceived him as normal the first time I saw him. He went past me without saying a word. The eyes at the back of his head watched me cautiously. I took another path to avoid him, but further down I saw him approaching. I went on trying to get away from him. It seemed we were caught in an invisible labyrinth. Every time I encountered him, he seemed more intent on me. When I came to a grove of blue trees, I hid behind one of them. Inside the tree, I heard loud and passionate voices, as if from an important meeting. I took a path, and to my shock, I saw myself approaching. I stopped, and the other person, who was me, said, "What are you doing here?" "Me?" "Yes, what about you?" "What about me?" "What are you doing here? Why do you ask?" "Because I want to know. I'm on a message." "What message?" "To you." "To me?" "Yes." "What is the message?" "I was sent to tell you to go home." "That's what I'm trying to do." "Are you sure?" "Yes, of course. Anyway, who sent you? Who do you think?" "I don't know." "Our king?" "What king?" "The great king." "Where is he?" "What sort of question is that?" There was a pause. I looked hard at the riddle who stood before me. He stared hard at me too. "You look like me," I said. "It is you who looks like me," he replied. Then as a suspicion of who he was began to draw on me, he said, "Take the path, dear, and you'll be all right." I looked where he was pointing and I saw the dog I followed earlier. When I looked back at the other person who was me, he had gone. I followed the dog and went down the path for some time. There was a blue stripe of clothes on the trees. The path narrowed, became tiny, and I felt I was walking on a wall. I had been keeping my eyes on the path, making sure I didn't deviate from it. I didn't notice that we broke out of the forest. When I looked up, I saw Madame Coteau in yellow dress, as if for a party. "Where have you been?" "I don't know," I said. She shook her head in mild exasperation and carried on to her destination. When she left, I couldn't find the dog anywhere and I went home. It had grown very dark. I got to our compound, hurried to our room and found no one in. Mom wasn't on the bed. The room was neat. The corner smelled of disinfectant. I left the room and wandered down the passages. No one seemed to be around. Then in the last room, I heard all the concentrated noises of the compound crowded into a single place.
There was a lot of shouting. Dad's voice kept rising above the din. When I looked into the room through a crack in the door, I saw the whole compound there, gathered in a boisterous meeting. There were no drinks on the table. On one side of the room, there were the creditors and their relations. The two that Dad had beaten up were shouting at the back. One of them had a machete, the other a club. Between them, in the center of the table, were the men and women of the compound. On the other side of the room were Mom and Dad and lots of children and the photographer who was busy taking pictures. The landlord was an arbitrator. Every time the flash went, the landlord stiffened into a pose. Dad was quiet and Mom looked well. One of the creditors said, "If you are so strong, why not become a boxer?" "I will," Dad replied. The other creditor said, "Why don't you join the army, use your muscles and get killed? It's only there that you are strong." The landlord held up his hands to command silence. The flash went. He stiffened. The creditors shouted about their money and their wounds. They sounded like children. Dad smiled. The landlord, amid flashes, gave his verdict. He fined Dad £10. A hefty fine indeed. The creditors were jubilant. The landlord said Dad should pay his debts and the fine in 1 week or move out of the compound. Then, with the jubilant voices claiming the air, he went on to additionally fine Dad a bottle of Ogogoro for the purposes of communal reconciliation. Dad said he had no money and that he would have to buy it on credit. The men of the compound laughed. The camera flashed. The landlord, in a moment of unusual magnanimity, offered to buy the Ogogoro of reconciliation. The compound people shared his wisdom. I sneaked away from the door and went to the house front and played with other children on the sand. Not long afterwards, I heard the compound voice emerge into the passage. I went to the backyard, washed my face and feet, and went to the room. Mom was bustling around as if she hadn't been ill. Her face was a little flushed and her eyes were bright. Recovery had charged her spirits and regenerated her face. Dad sat on a chair smoking. He looked happy. Food was spread out on the table. The wound on Dad's head had healed. His bad hand no longer dangled. "Where have you been?" he asked. Mom rushed to me and held me to her and I breathed in her body smells. It felt as if I had been away for days, as if I had wandered off into a phase of forgetfulness. "My son," Mom cried, her eyes usually brilliant, unusually brilliant. Dad put out his cigarette and said, "You missed the compound meeting. They fined me. I got tired of waiting for you, so I came home. Your mother is well now. The gods have answered our prayers." I held on to Mom. Dad continued, "Sit down and eat. From tomorrow up till the time you begin school, you will stay at Madame Koto's bar. You will stay there for a few minutes every day." "Eh?" I nodded. I washed my hands. We ate together and Dad kept playing me with choice bits of crayfish, plying me with choice bits of crayfish and chicken, while Mom carefully took out the bones from the spiky fresh fish and fed me juicy morsels. The room was bright with their radiance. I felt strange. I had missed the important moment which had transformed the light in our world. We finished eating and I took the plates to the backyard and washed them. On my way, I passed one of the creditors that Dad had beaten up. His face was bruised, ferocious and cowardly. When he went past, he gave me a secretive knock on the head. When I got to our room, my eyes were watering. Mom and Dad were sitting together on the bed. Mom looked at me and said, "Look, our son is crying with happiness." I smiled and the pain eased. I cleared the center table, spread the mats and stretched out. Dad went to his chair. The candle burned slow and Mom lit another one. I watched the mystery of the flame. Mom arranged her provisions in a basin. "I'm going to start trading again," she said. Dad smiled. "My wife is a serious businesswoman," he said. Then he looked at me. "People think I will make a good boxer. A man across the street saw me when I beat up the creditors. He said he would introduce me to some trainers and managers. A good trainer, free of charge." He laughed. He punched the air and rocked backwards. "I'll be a great boxer. People say there's money in boxing." He hit out at the chair again. He began to punch the candle flame, putting it out with each perfect execution and relighting it. "I fight fire, I become fire. Anyone who fights me fights the sun." He laughed again. I kept on watching the mystery of the flame. Mom made a wary sound. I looked and saw she wasn't happy about Dad becoming a boxer. She was counting her small change. She said, "Your father used to box and wrestle in the village. They used to call him Black Tiger. He beat up all the young men. One day before a fight, he punched a big hole in the wall of his father's enemy." Dad laughed out loud. Mom continued, "The enemy put a curse on him. Then people went around saying that if your father fought again, he would be beaten. They said he would go mad for 1 week. Your father stopped fighting. The villagers gave his title to somebody else, but his supporters kept coming to get him to fight and win back his title as champion of the village. They all bet heavily on him. At first, your father refused, and then out of pride, he accepted. The man, a small man, threw your father on the ground. In the last round, your father lost. But I didn't go mad for 1 week. That was all village talk. But you came to the city. Yes, I came to the city. The boats fell silent. It seemed almost as if they had come to hell. Mom finished counting her small change and sat on the bed. Dad sighed. I haven't seen my father in 5 years, he said. Suddenly, a rat began chewing away at something beneath the cupboard. A big fly started up as if it had just woken from a long sleep and buzzed out about the room. A moth rose from Dad's boots and circled the candle flame in a descending spiral. Dad lit a cigarette and smoked meditatively. The noise of the rat increased and other rats joined in the chewing. Mom's face twitched. Dad said, "Your father is completely blind now. He's the head priest of our shrine. Priest of the God of Roads. Anyone who wants a special sacrifice for their journeys, undertakings, births, funerals, whatever goes to him. All human beings travel the same road." He paused then continued. "I was supposed to succeed him as priest, but the elders of the village said your son is a fighter. How can a fighter be the priest of Roads? The gods has chosen a successor outside your family. But who knows the future? Your grandfather was very disappointed about this. He's blind now and he wears dark glasses and wanders through the forest and through the village and the world without any walking stick or any help. Our old people are very powerful in spirit. They have all kinds of powers." His voice was very sad. "We are forgetting these powers. Now all the power that people have is selfishness, pony, and politics." The rats went on eating. The moth came too close to the candle flame and fell into the wax. The smoke from its burnt wings was dense and didn't rise high, and the moth whittled in the wax and caught fire. I blew out two flames, took the moth from the wax, and lit the candle again. Dad said, "The only power poor people have is their hunger." Mom said, "Those rats." She stretched her limbs on the bed. Dad finished his cigarette. I got out my pillow and cover cloth. Dad blew out the candle and I listened to the rats eating and the fly buzzing in the darkness. Dad got into bed. The springs creaked. The rats went on chewing and Dad in the darkness said, "Azaro, rats can be our friends. They can sometimes tell what is happening in the world. They are our spies. Listen to them, Azaro. And tomorrow tell me what the rats are saying." I listened to the rats. One of them had teeth of yellow diamonds. They didn't seem to be saying anything, and soon I heard bird springs creaking in their particular rhythm of other nights. The movement of the bed overcame the noise of the rats. I slept and woke up and heard Mom sighing differently, and the bed shook and humped. Shapes wandered about in the darkness, and I slept again. I woke suddenly and the bed still moved, and soon I didn't notice the musical creaking of the springs. If I could hear beneath those sounds the shrill intensity of the rats. Just before I fell asleep again, I stopped hearing the bed altogether, because I suddenly realized that if I tried hard enough, I could understand the language of rats. They were saying as they ate their way through Mom's sack of garri that the world is tougher than fire or steel. I didn't understand what they meant, and I dozed off trying to get them to explain it to me. But they couldn't understand me because, unlike us, they speak only one language. So we're done with book one. We're going into book two next week, God willing, or probably the week after, because we're going to do the episode with Farida. Me and Farida are going to go through like journey so far and stuff like that. But now you're listening to bloopers. I call them bloopers, but yeah, it's a whole laugh. Business tones, as though they were about to form a limited liability company. Dad went amongst them, scattering the meeting. They tried to run to their different rooms, but Dad called them back, each by his particular name, and he insulted them for 15 incandescent minutes. They bore his insults in silence. When he had finished with When he had finished with when he had finished with them, turning with his unique when he had finished with them, turning with
get your life, sir.
When he had finished with them, turning with his unique dismissive flourish. Oh my God. This man. Get your life set. Okay. When he had finished with them, turning with his unique dismissive flourish and storming back to our room, everyone was aware that we had just... Oh my god. It's just the imagery. This man. Oh my god. When he had finished with them, turning with his unique dismissive flourish and storming back to our room, everyone was... Oh, I shall not skip this paragraph because the imagery is just epic. Oh my god. Ooh. Get your life, Hikma. When he had finished with them, turning with his unique and dismissive flourish and coming back to our room, everyone was aware that we had just... I think I'll skip this place. I'm so tired. Okay, I'm laughing like a lunatic. Oh God. The imagery is just epic. Azari is just there, embarrassed with his parents' behavior, but he can't do shit.